Okay, I'd like to begin with a land acknowledgement. In this very room, Jody Shaw, Matt Taibbi, Greg Lukianoff, Ricky Schlott, and Barry Strauss spoke before the Heterodox Academy campus communities at Cornell University and SUNY Cortland and their allies, the Cornell Political Union, on the importance of free speech. Now for the politically incorrect part. Dad Sad is my hero. Dad's life has been defined. Dad's life has been defined by his love of truth and freedom. And I say love of truth and freedom because these are not academic words involving the head, but also deeply held values involving the heart. Dad is unique. Dad is unique among academics in being both brilliant in obtaining evidence and using reason to draw conclusions, but he also has a heart, the courage of his convictions to voice his conclusions based on evidence and reason. In an academic environment of cowardly, heartless, and mindless groupthink, and he does it with humor. And my neighbor on my floor said I should also add, it's a soulless place. Dad is a professor of the people and considers it a part of his job description to engage with the public. Dad has written several popular books, including The Parasitic Mind, The Sad Truth About Happiness, and he's now writing a book called Suicidal Empathy. Dad also has his own YouTube channel and has appeared on Joe Rogan's and Jordan Peterson's podcast, and was an early supporter of Jordan Peterson when Jordan found himself in hot water for not conforming to compelled speech demanded by Bill C-16 to use arbitrary and capricious pronouns. Dad is a modern-day Till Eulenspiegel who fearlessly calls out intellectual dishonesty and incoherent ideological dogma of moral relativism with its internal contradictions and premature claims that the science, trademark, is either irrelevant or settled. I want to read a few sentences from The Parasitic Mind. Without the necessary freedoms, it would be impossible to instantiate my second life ideal, namely the pursuit and defense of truth. There is a bidirectional relationship between truth and freedom, such that the truth will set you free. Some of you recognize that, I know. John 8:32. And only in being free can one aspire to uncover the truth. A university must choose one of two teloi, the search for truth or social justice. Trademark. President Pollack contends that the two are not incompatible, but de facto has chosen the telos of social justice through its arbitrary, capricious abhorrence of words that wound, to quote Kimberly Crenshaw, and the calling out of microaggressions and the promotion of anonymous biased reporting. These lead to self-censorship and puts a damper on the search for truth. I want to thank Gad for being so supportive of free speech and the search for truth at Cornell, a postmodern Ivy League university that Gad dearly loves. Gad received his MS and PhD at Cornell in 1963 and 1964. Not only was Gad...
1993.
I'm a child of the 60s.
Gad received his MS and PhD at Cornell in 1993 and 1994. Not only does Gad adore Cornell, but he's also adored. Is Jay Russo here? Gad's major professor is coming. Hannah Silverstein, a fellow student, had him for dinner last night. Tom Gilovich.
Must be the traffic.
Is coming. And Dennis Regan could not make it. Please do say hello to Gad Sad for me. But April 9th is my daughter's birthday, and they'll be far away. And David Dunning could not be here. Thanks for the invite, but I now work at the University of Michigan. And worse, I'm at sabbatic at Arizona State. So I'll not be in town. Do give my regards to Gad, who I do remember, and I hope his old soccer injury is a long forgotten memory.
Sure.
So Gad ends his book, The Parasitic Chronicle. Gad ends his book, The Sad Truth About Happiness, with these words. My recipe for the good life includes, 1, finding the right spouse. On that note, I'd like to thank my wife, Amy, who brings me so much happiness. It's all Judy. In no small way has really made all these talks possible. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you all for having the courage to be here.
Thank you so much. So let me check. It's not on? Is it on? No. I'm pressing it.
That thing went. Oh, yeah. No, sorry. Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. I've had several lovely introductions in my career, none of which led to such a beautiful emotional moment. So I think I'm going to put that on my CV. Thank you all for coming. I didn't know. Randy told me that it takes great courage to show up to this thing. I didn't think that it required so much courage. So thank you for your courage in showing up to my talk. Some of us went through the Lebanese Civil War. That took courage. Apparently, it takes equal courage to just show up to a talk at Cornell. So today, what I'd like to do is give an overview of some of the things that, regrettably, I've been warning about in academia for several decades that resulted in me writing The Parasitic Mind. But notwithstanding that there is some evidence that things are improving, there's still a lot of work to be done. So hopefully, all the people who are here will help and effect some change. Let me just give you, Randy gave a bit of a history of my relationship with Cornell. This first photo here is me while I was a student here. This is when I came back in 2000 as a visiting professor at the Johnson School. This is in 2001 when I spoke at the, I think it was at the Statler School, and our children were this young at the time. This was taken during that visit, so I proudly am in embedding them within the Cornell brand. This is when I was, you shouldn't use the word obese, you should use words like differently weighted. This is when I used to be differently weighted. In 2012, I came here to speak about the consuming instinct, which is an area of my main area of research, which is applying evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology in the behavioral sciences. This is 2 years ago when several of Jay Russo's students, he was my supervisor for my PhD, he's a cognitive psychologist, we came back to Ithaca to honor him on his retirement. So I guess he's not here yet, but he's supposed to be here. I hope he does show up. And then the next slide is me trying to fit in at Cornell because I hear that it is a truly supremely woke place. So this is my alter ego, Fierce Sally. I love smashing capitalism. Ask me about my pronouns. You got Revolucion with Che Guevara. And this is actually a clip that I posted after I came back from this trip because it truly was that Ithaca was the epicenter of wokeness. I didn't remember it as such when I was at Cornell. And as Randy said, I have infinite love for Cornell, but maybe not some of the parasitic infestations that we see at Cornell. So hopefully I can help in administering some of the mind vaccines that are necessary. Why did I use the parasitic framework in describing some of these issues? Well, as you probably know, and certainly now that we faced COVID, human beings have faced a slew of pathogenic realities, whether it be viruses or parasites or bacteria or fungi. But of course, I argue that human minds can also suffer from a second class of neuroparasites. These are beliefs, ideas, attitudes that are parasitic in nature. And I'll try to explain what I mean by parasitic in a few minutes by also drawing some examples from the animal kingdom. So here's an example from the animal kingdom. Here you've got a spider wasp that stings a much larger spider, rendering it zombified, and then it carries it to its burrow where it lays eggs on it, and then when the offspring hatch, they get to eat the spider in vivo. And so I argue that political correctness is very much akin to the spider wasp sting, right? We haplessly walk into the abyss of infinite lunacy quietly and according to plan. Here's another example. This one some of you may have heard of. It can also infect human minds. Toxoplasma gondii, but the most famous example is when it infects the minds of mice. When a mouse is infected with that particular neuroparasite, it loses its innate fear of cats, and it actually becomes sexually attracted to the cat's urine, which is a rather maladaptive preference to have if you're a cat. In this case, these are neuroparasites that affect ungulates, moose, deer, elk, and so when they are parasitized by this parasite, they will start engaging in what's called circling behavior. They keep going around, kind of bobbing their head in a circle. Even as the predators are coming, they can't extricate themselves from this pattern. They can't instantiate their flight mechanism. And so as you can see, it's a very apt metaphor to describe some of the idea pathogens that regrettably all stem from university campuses. And so that's why I use the parasitic framework. Rather than say a mimetic framework. All right. So this is a figure from the parasitic mind. What are some of these idea pathogens? There's a whole bunch that I describe in the book, but I'll just put a few up here for you to see. So here you've got the granddaddy of all idea pathogens, postmodernism. Postmodernism basically purports that there are no universal truths, no objective truths, other than the one objective truth, that there are no objective truths. And so, as you might imagine, postmodernism then provides the mechanism by which all of these other idea pathogens can flourish. Men are women, up is down, left is right, my truth, not the truth, and so on. So in the book, I kind of go through many of these idea pathogens, and I demonstrate how many of the public policy issues that today we are debating originally stem from many of these parasitic ideas. And I'll show you many examples of these in a second. So tsunami of lunacy as a form of intellectual terrorism, there are several elements to this tsunami. Attacks on scientific truths, right? Men too can menstruate, right? So until about 15 minutes ago, the 117 billion people that had ever lived on Earth seem to exactly know how to navigate through the very, very complicated conundrum of what constitutes male or female as a sexually reproducing species consisting of two phenotypes, male and female. But apparently now that was all wrong. So attacks on scientific truth, attacks on the epistemology for seeking scientific truth, that's what postmodernism does, and then, of course, attacks on the ethos of meritocracy. And I'll just give a few examples of the last one. So here's one. This is the smaller bar is what the average GPA used to be many years ago, and through the years, it keeps going up. So either students have become shockingly more intelligent over the past 30, 40 years, or there might be a tad bit of grade inflation. And I'll give you a few other figures that demonstrate that. The average grade used to be in the past a C, as you would exactly expect from a normal distribution. The average grade at many universities now is an A. So let me repeat that. The average grade is an A. So again, we must have an epidemic of super, super bright people. Standards have also reduced drastically. So here I wrote a paper, an article a few years ago where I said, I'll have a large fries, a hamburger, a Diet Coke, and an MBA, hold the pickles. What I meant by that is that if you look at the pattern of what is required to get an MBA, when I got an MBA prior to coming to Cornell, I had to go through 67 credits, which was a very, very intense 2 full years of really jam-packed courses, 5, 6, 7 graduate courses a semester for 2 years. Now you can get an MBA in 1 year. you can get 45 credits. So again, you've taken off a third, at times half, of the credits that were required only 20, 30 years ago. Medical schools are starting to do that. Instead of four-year medical programs, they're becoming three, because, you know, we have to respond to the market conditions. Students don't have time to sit there and waste time studying. You have to respond to the market conditions. The customer is king. Let's continue with the attack on meritocracy. This is from the Canada Research Chair, call for research chairs. So this is the highest chaired professorship that you can have endowed in Canada. The endower is the Canadian government. So if you hold the Canada Research Chair, it's a really prestigious thing. You would think that, of course, it would all be based on merit. It's anything but that. It's, am I transgender? Am I indigenous? What's the skin hue that I have? Do I suffer from dermatological original sin? So that will determine whether I get those Canada researchers. And if you think I'm being satirical or hyperbolic, I will actually show you specific language, and you won't believe that it's possible. This, by the way, is a case that is just unbelievable. I mean, you truly think it's just satirical. This is a law professor at UBC, University of British Columbia, who didn't get tenure because, you know, she didn't publish anything. And so she decided that in her culture, which is an oral tradition culture, you know, this thing of writing that would have resulted in her publishing papers was contrary to the ethos of her culture. Therefore, to ask her to have published things for tenure would have been an attack on her culture. And the Human Rights Tribunal said, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Let's hear that case. I mean, that's not a good thing, right? So this is University of Waterloo is kind of the MIT of Canada. It's where a lot of the top engineering students, I mean, there are many great engineering schools in Canada, but Waterloo is kind of, as I said, MIT, Caltech. A lot of the computer science stuff has happened at Waterloo. So this is, again, a NSERC, which is the National Science Engineering Research Council. So this is the NSERC Tier 1 Canada Research Chair. So this is the top of the top when it comes to being endowed for a chaired professorship in computer science in Canada. Let me read you what we expect of you for the two positions. This is straight out of, I took a screenshot from University of Waterloo. For position one, we're looking for all areas of artificial intelligence. The call is open only to qualified individuals who self-identify as women, transgender, gender fluid, non-binary, or two-spirit. And then for the second position, all areas of computer science, the call is open only to qualified individuals who self-identify as a member of racialized minority. I mean, it would be problematic if it was just racialized minority, but it's if you self-identify as a racialized minority. So if I think that indigenous is the way to game the system, I stop being a Lebanese Jew, I become part of the Mi'kmaq tribe, and I better get that chaired professorship. That's a really nice way to adjudicate decisions. This is me a few years ago. I hate to say that my satire is prophetic, but my satire is prophetic. When people would write to me and say, oh, you know, you warn about all these things, but these are just things that are in some esoteric, silly humanities department. It's never going to happen in neuroscience. It's not going to happen in psychology. It's not going to happen in engineering. It's not going to happen in medicine or in physics or in chemistry. I say, oh, it's going to happen in all those. And let me preempt it by showing you how it's going to happen in mathematics, which by definition, if there ever was a field that where your identity could not matter, it would be in mathematics, right? It's an axiomatic closed system, right? There is no Lebanese Jewish way to study distribution of prime numbers, right? There is no algebraic topology that's indigenous. There's just algebraic topology. And so I released the clip wearing my super woke wig, and I argued that there's now going to be a new field called social justice mathematics. And I, because I have a mathematics background, I said, We need to stop using words like irrational numbers because that marginalizes mental illness.
Oh.
We need to stop with the inequality operator because that creates an ableist. I had a whole huge big thing. And I would receive emails from professors in math departments saying, we sit there in the faculty lounge watching this clip and laughing. Okay? Well, guess what? A few years later, we find out that US professor says that math is unearned privilege of white people. But I predicted it several years earlier. Now, why am I able to do that? Because you take a principle that's insane, you extrapolate to its boundary condition, you satirize it, and then you cross your fingers and you wait for the stupidity to catch up. And that's exactly what happens. The Quebec minister got into, the deputy minister of science or the environment got into a lot of trouble because when they were talking about some environmental impact studies, he said, well, there is no indigenous way to do science. There's just science. He then had to walk it back and apologize. Well, there is no indigenous way to do science, just like there is no Lebanese Jewish way to do science. There's just science. Science liberates us from the shackles of our personal identities. That's what makes it beautiful. That's what makes it epistemologically democratic, right? These guys started a movement at University of Cape Town, hashtag science must fall, because science is part of whiteness, right? Darwin, white. Newton, white. Plato, white. Socrates, white. And so we have to look at that with suspicion, right? This is at my university. The 5-year strategic plan was just released, passed around to the entire university. The number one item in our strategic plan, this, I swear this is not, I'm not being satirical. As a matter of fact, I brought literally the screenshots, is to decolonize and indigenize all of our curriculum. So irrespective of which field you're in, so I teach psychology of decision making, consumer psychology, evolutionary psychology, behavioral decision theory, I need to now, you know, in my best honest effort, find ways to decolonize and indigenize evolutionary psychology. And everyone should be doing it, whether you're teaching Shakespeare, or you're in Judaic studies, or you're in neuroscience. That is the fundamental principle. Because, you know, in the past, indigenous people in Canada were treated badly, and so who cares about science? Who cares about reason? We're going to indigenize. And here is, by the way, I don't even know what these words mean, but we're supposed to abide by them. So let me just read them for you for fun. So this is the ethical principles and strategic priorities that we should implement in our curriculum. This is at a major research university in Canada in the 21st century. Announced at a launch event at Fourth Space, the plan draws upon the principles embodied in the two-row, one-pump belt, I don't know what that means, or Tekani Teotatati Kaswanta, an ethical framework for how colonial settler governments are to conduct themselves, and on and on and on. So I need to read that ethical statement and see, you know, do some introspection and see how I can implement all that within all of my teaching and future research. This is, might interest some of the students who are physicists here. We have, I think it's a $500,000 grant from the Canadian government to decolonize light. Light, as a physics phenomenon, needs to be indigenized and decolonized. We have $500,000 if any of you are interested. This is a recent thing. Some of you may have seen this. There's an AI Gemini thing that Google released. And it turns out that the way it was programmed, white people cease to exist. So you enter anything you want. George Washington, he comes out as, you know, I don't know, maybe it's this guy. Okay? And so on and so forth. And actually, a whole bunch of people started gaming the system to see if they could ever and so now they've taken it off shelf to try to work on it. But again, these are not just esoteric, idiotic ideas that fester in the ecosystem of universities. They escape from the university ecosystem, and they become the Prime Minister of Canada. This is also with AI. where this one, someone sent me this, a fan sent me this. It asked the AI system, who is more evil, Mao Zedong, you know, who killed 50 plus million people, or Gad Saad? So I can understand why the room is not completely full today, because I am, after all, someone who could stand proudly. So you should read this, or I can send it to you. It's very tough to tell whether Gad Saad, the evolutionary psychologist in Canada, or the genocidal killer of 50 plus million people. It's really relative. It's a tough call. We can't tell, really. That's what happens when wokeness invades our capacity to think. Now, this story, some of you may have heard it before if you follow my work. Many may have not. Even if you've heard it, it's worth hearing it in person. So here it goes. This is demonstrating the insanity of, well, this certainly, but even more so this. And you'll see in a second why I've got these two figures. 2002, I was a visiting professor at University of California, Irvine. And then I took a break from that to go to a visiting professorship at Dartmouth. And my doctoral student in Montreal was defending his doctoral dissertation. He defended it. I drove back to Montreal. He defended it. And we were then going out to dinner to celebrate him having obtained his PhD. He's now actually himself a chaired professor in Canada. So we were going out to dinner, myself, my wife, my doctoral student at the time, and he was bringing a date. So he calls me nervously about 2-3 hours before we were meeting, and he goes, oh, I just want to give you a heads up that the person that I'm bringing is a graduate student in cultural anthropology, women's study, and postmodernism. I said, ah, okay, so the holy trinity of bullshit. And I said, oh, no, I got you. I'm going to be on my best behavior. This is your night. I'm going to be good. Like, don't worry about it. No, nothing's going to happen. Which, of course, was a complete lie. So about halfway through the evening, I turned to the lady in question, and I said, oh, I hear you're a postmodernist graduate student. She goes, yes. I said, there are no universal truths, yes? No. I said, well, do you mind? I mean, I work under the premise that there are certain universal truths. For example, evolutionary psychology does purport that there are some human universals that you can find in the Yanomamo tribe in the Amazon, and you could find in Detroit, Michigan in the 1950s, and you could find it in Ithaca today. Those are called human universals. So do you mind if I propose what I think are human universals and or universals, and then we can discuss it? She goes, yeah, go for it. This is 2002, way before the transgender stuff. Is it not true that only women bear children? So she looks at me, can't believe that someone could be such a simpleton, and says, no, it's not true. I said, it's not true? How so? So then she says that there is some Japanese tribe off some Japanese island where within the folkloric realm, it is the men who bear children. So by you restricting it to the material, biological realm, that's how you keep us, barefoot and pregnant. So after I recovered from the mini stroke I had at listening to this, I said, okay, well, maybe it was too controversial when I tried to tackle something as corrosive as only women bear children. So let me take a slightly less controversial example. Is it not true that within any vantage point on Earth, sailors have relied on the premise that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west? So here she used a variant of postmodernism called deconstructionism by Jacques Derrida. Deconstructionism argues that language creates reality. There is no reality outside that which you name. So then she says, what do you mean by east and west? And what do you mean by the sun? That which you call the sun, I might call dancing hyena. I said, well, fine, the dancing hyena rises in the east and sets in the west. And she said, no, I don't play those label games. Now, why did that story become such an infamous story in the lore of postmodernism? Because if I can't find an intersection of meaning with a graduate student at a leading university in Canada where we can agree that a sexually reproducing species, it is the women who bear children.
And there is such a thing as the sun. You know, the one where we had the total eclipse yesterday?
Yeah.
The dancing hyena eclipse. So if I can't agree with you on that, it's a dead end. It's an epistemological dead end. So not only can you not solve anything in science or reason or literature or in anything that involves intellectual enrichment, but you're wasting your parents' precious hard work earned money in wasting time doing this kind of garbage. It does nothing for you, right? It's a Darwinian dead end. Another idea pathogen that regrettably I saw very early in my academic career, where I was trying to Darwinize the behavioral sciences, applying evolutionary theory in understanding human behavior. Most social scientists are social constructivists. We are born tabula rasa, and it's only socialization that then makes men be the way they are, that makes women the way they are. Right? That's called a social constructivist argument. Now, in a small sense, of course, socialization does occur. But socialization occurs in its forms because of biology, not contra biology. Okay? And so one of the ways that I like to demonstrate that is via the example of the sex specificity of toy preferences. The reason I use that example is because usually social constructivists argue that that's where the nefarious gender roles begin, right? Little boys are taught to play, rough and tumble with the trucks and the guns. Little girls are taught to play in a nurturing way with the pink doll. And there goes the cascade of gender role specialization. And so if I want to prove to the most hostile audience of social constructivists that toy preferences are actually biological based, how would I go about doing that? And this is how I do it. This is something that I talk about in chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind. So this is called a nomological network of cumulative evidence. For anybody who's here who's a student or a professor, if you don't retain anything else from my talk today, I hope you retain many things, then certainly retain this epistemological powerhouse. What a nomological network of cumulative evidence does is it says, what is all of the evidence that I could amass across time, across cultures, across species, across methodologies, across theoretical frameworks, so that I can triangulate the veracity of my position? It's a lot more than merely a literature review. A literature review is very narrow. This is much broader. So I won't go through the entire network, but so I want to prove to you that there is a biological basis of toy preferences. It's not socially constructed. How would I go do that? Okay, so let me show you a few ways. Well, this is from developmental psychology, this square right here. Well, I can show you that children who are too young to be socialized, in other words, by definition, they haven't yet reached the cognitive developmental stage to be socialized, already exhibit those sex-specific toy preferences. They're 3 months old, 6 months old. They couldn't have been socialized, but they already exhibit. So even if I stopped the network right here, I've pretty much already put a death nail in your coffin, but I'm not going to stop there. How about I get you data from clinical endocrinology showing you that little girls who suffer from congenital adrenal hyperplasia, that's a mouthful, which basically means that their behaviors and their morphology, because they have an endocrinological problem, becomes masculinized. So girls who suffer from CAH, guess what happens to their toy preferences? They become fully reversed. They become like those of boys. Now it's starting to look bad for the social constructivists, but I'm not going to stop there. How about I get you data from other species? How about I get you data from vervet monkeys and rhesus monkeys and chimpanzees, showing you that they exhibit the exact same sex specificity of toy preferences as human infants? Well, you're going to have to now really use a lot of mental gymnastics to argue that the baby rhesus monkey has patriarchal parents who are teaching him gender stereotypes, right? So bit by bit, I put the epistemological noose, figuratively, around your neck because I drown you in a tsunami of evidence. Now, it's a very effortful process, but if you are committed to the process, then you win any argument. That's why people say, well, how come it's so hard to cancel you? Well, first, who could cancel this face? But number two, Because if you're going to debate me and I've built this network, good luck to you. You better come correct and not miss, because otherwise it's going to be trouble for you. So I'm very calibrated. If you ask me a question about something that I don't know about, I'll say, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't have the necessary expertise to speak. So I don't overstep my knowledge. I never get caught with my pants down, so to speak. But if you ask me about topics that I've built the requisite neurological network, well then, let's have at it. And so that's what allows me to then go into very hairy situations and come out unscathed. This is continuing with this. So some people said, oh yeah, but it's the woke stuff, the parasitic stuff is never going to come to medicine. I mean, medicine is too practically important to actually find its way there. No way. This is verbatim. I transcribed the entire thing from this gentleman, who is the dean at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities Medical class. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just read a few things. So we recognize inequities built by past and present traumas rooted in white supremacy, colonialism, the gender binary. These are future physicians. Ableism and all sorts of, and it goes on and on and on. Now, it used to be that you had to say the Hippocratic Oath after Hippocrates, the ancient Greek physician. Now you say the woke oath. It's insane. Now let's keep going in case that hasn't alarmed you enough. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine, which is arguably the most prestigious academic medical journal. The editors of the journal didn't find it necessary to maybe spend a few extra pages, you know, solving cancer. Instead, they had Deborah Cohen write a very, very long self-flagellation. I apologize for being white and a physician. I am so wrong for having been white. I'm sorry for having learned white medicine, and on and on. Imagine that's your physician, that's your surgeon. So bad ideas are not just esoteric things that just stay within some humanities department. They become our physicians, they become our surgeons, they become our prime ministers, and on and on. It's not good. This is me speaking in 2017 in front of the Canadian Senate about what was then called, I mean, it still is called Bill C-16, but at the time it hadn't passed yet. Bill C-16 was the bill that sought to incorporate gender expression and gender orientation within the hate crime rubric. And I was asked to come and testify. Let me repeat it here, although it shouldn't be that I need to say it. Of course, I support the right of every individual to live in any way that they wish. Live and let live. Of course, I wish for everybody to live free of bigotry. That doesn't mean that you take me on your ride to celebrate your unique personhood. It doesn't mean that we remove from the passport, you know, these markers called male and female, because what happens if you're one of the 50,000, one in 50,000 that believes that they are non-binary? So our most fundamental marker of our personhood is lost, because now we need to cater to the tyranny of the minority. And so when I explained all that in front of the Canadian Senate, and I said, here is what's going to happen, and I hate to say it, go listen to it, it's exactly what I predicted, and kudos to my partisan free thinker in Canada, Jordan Peterson, who also tried to warn them, but Jordan has now retired from academia, so I stand as the lone wolf in Canada fighting against the tsunami of insanity. It's not pretty, let me tell you. Well, this senator said, what you are arguing here, I was basically arguing that there really is such a thing as male and female for sexually reproducing species called Homo sapiens. That's what I was arguing. He said, you are promulgating genocide against transgender people. To which I said, you might want to be careful about using this kind of accusations from someone who escaped execution in the Middle East. And that kind of threw him off guard. But that's the kind of theater, political theater of the absurd that you see amongst our politicians. Of course, this is just so I don't want to keep you out, because we're in the U.S.
I want you to feel inclusive and welcomed and heard. This is a person who is now sitting on the 9-person Supreme Court. When asked by this person, can you define what a woman is? You know all this, but it's worth repeating. She pauses, she stutters, and says, well, I'm not a biologist, so how could I answer that? Again, the 117 billion people who had existed until this confirmation hearing seemed to be able to navigate through choosing who's male or female in reproducing. But she doesn't know that. She's not a biologist. Now, of course she knows what it is. But the fact that she's existing in a lunatic epistemological world where she doesn't have the confidence to say, what kind of insane question is that? Of course I know what a woman is, tells you how far we've gotten. I get emails from grown adults, dear Professor Saad, I'm just wondering, is it accepted science now that men too can menstruate? And I write back, dear so-and-so, no. So the fact that that person has been so unstable in the ground that they're standing on, to have to get the imprimatur of a professor to tell them who menstruates, tells you that it's parasitic, it's a problem. This is my interaction. This is the actual lady with whom I was interacting. She's an anesthesiologist who first told me to shut my mouth because she's a physician of color. So, to which I answered, I'm a child war refugee of color. So I outrank you by far. Be careful. Don't play victimology poker with me. You lose. So that already got her unstable because she was trying to use that calculus she lost in it. But she explained to me that you didn't go to medical school. I did. And stop saying things like men don't menstruate. This is an anesthesiologist. She administers the dosage of anesthesiology based on whether you're male or female. She publicly chastised me. By the way, I've published a lot of papers in journals that she couldn't even pronounce their names on the menstrual cycle. But I wasn't a physician of color. And I'm a man, therefore I didn't go through the experience of menstruating. And therefore, shut your mouth. Sorry?
How do we know you didn't?
Very true. Very true. By the way, I recently announced, I'll take questions at the end. My biological female wife recently announced to me that she now self-identifies as a male. So I'm proud to say that I stand before you today as a gay man. So whatever part of my victimology poker hadn't yet been met, I now also tick that off. So don't come at me, you will lose a victimology poker. Speaking of menstruation, this is happening. It's a one-day scientific symposium at my university. And by the way, my university is very woke, but this could have been at Cornell, it could have been at Harvard. They're holding a one-day scientific conference, symposium, for big thinkers, on menstrual equity and on the fact that menstruation is a human right. Because until we got a bunch of luminaries to sit together, women had not been allowed that right to menstruate. So we need to hold a symposium at Concordia for menstrual equity. Now you might say, okay, but who cares? Eventually they'll grow out of this stupidity. But how about the funds that are being wasted on this? How about the attack, the murder and rape of truth, of reason? Really, in the 21st century, this is what we're coming up with? That's what happens when you get a parasitic infestation that attacks, it creates a madness of crowds, right? Throw the woman in the swimming pool. Throw her, she's a witch. If she drowns, then we were wrong. If she swims, then we were right that she was a witch. It's the exact same principle. The template of parasitic thinking has always existed within the architecture of the human mind. The only thing that's different today is the specific parasitic pathogens, postmodernism, cultural relativism, and so on. Let's keep going. This is a recent, at the recent anthropology meetings, the Canadian and U.S. Anthropological Society, so this is the premier anthropologist meetings. They ended up canceling a session and deeply apologizing because there were five female anthropologists who wanted to argue that there are many cases in archaeology and in anthropology where it makes perfect sense to be studying this thing called biological sex. Let's say when you're doing archaeological excavations where you can tell through forensic anthropology if it's a male or female, right? So they just wanted to reintroduce the idea that, no, no, biological sex really does matter in anthropology and archaeology. Well, they had to cancel that session, and they put out a huge letter of apology. Okay. This is not in Waziristan in the contested territories of the Taliban. This is the premier anthropological society of Canada and the United States. Let's keep going. Look at this beautiful woman, Dylan Mulvaney. These are three physicians. The reason I take the screenshots is because I bring the receipts. Okay? These are three physicians, I think two of whom are gynecologists, who publicly chastised anyone who said that this wasn't a full woman stop, or period, forgive the pun. Is that really possible? Is it truly possible that an OBGYN could feel sufficiently emboldened to go on social media and troll and attack people who say, come on, really? And they say, you're an idiot. Yes, really, that's a woman. So let's talk now, let's move to some other topics so we condemn freedom of speech that hurts other people's feelings. So here what I'd like to talk about is something that actually when Randy and I first met a couple of years ago, I was giving an invited lecture at an academic freedom conference at Stanford University, and the topic of my lecture that day was on the distinction between deontological and consequentialist ethics. I'll spend a few minutes on it because it's really relevant to what's happening in academia. Deontological ethics are absolute statements of truth or morality, right? So if I say, for example, it is never okay to lie, that would be a deontological statement. If I say, well, it is okay to lie to spare someone's feelings, then that's a consequential statement. So I always tell people that if you want to have a long-lasting and happy marriage, when you hear the following question, do I look fat in those jeans? Then very quickly put on your consequentialist hat and say, absolutely not, you've never looked more beautiful. So there are times when it makes perfect sense for any of us to be consequentialist in our ethical bent. But when it comes to truth, when it comes to science, when it comes to freedom of speech, when it comes to freedom of inquiry, those are deontological principles by definition. Once you say, I believe in freedom of speech, but that's not good. So let me give you an example of what happens when you do that. Here's, and some of the people who've committed this, these transgressions, used to be former friends of mine. Not that I stopped being friends with people because they're imbeciles, but in this case, it's so egregious, some of the stuff that they were saying, that they really truly did piss me off. So here's one. But each of these are a violation of the deontological principle. And now I'm speaking in their voice. By the way, each of these positions is also called 95% of professors, okay? So, oh, of course I believe in freedom of speech. Oh, I'm all about freedom of speech. But it is perfectly reasonable to have banned Donald Trump from Twitter because he's simply too dangerous to be allowed to spew his garbage. No, that means you're a consequentialist. You decide that there are certain special asterisk cases of people that shouldn't be given freedom of speech, right? I'm Jewish. I left Lebanon, I support the right of the most offensive speech, Holocaust deniers. There can't be, by definition, something more insulting. Not only because of the reality, but it's such a falsehood. It's such an offensive falsehood. But in a free society, you support imbeciles, you support the right of falsehood spreaders, of racists, of anti-Semites. You beat them with better ideas. Let's go on. Oh, of course I support presumption of innocence. That's a bedrock of American jurisprudence, Western jurisprudence. But not for Brett Kavanaugh. Because Brett Kavanaugh was a gang rapist going up and down the Eastern Seaway, raping everything in sight. We don't have to worry if there is evidence in support of him. It's too important a decision to grant him the courtesy of presumption of innocence. So yes, in the abstract, I support presumption of innocence, just not for the gang rapist, Brett Kavanaugh. Here's the third one. Oh, of course I support the need for an impartial, truth-telling press. We need a healthy, honest press for a democracy to function properly. But not when it came to the Hunter Biden laptop. Because had that story come out, then there's all evidence showing that then Orange Himmler would have won. And so it was perfectly reasonable to suppress that story because it was unique to the asteroid that was coming at us. And then finally, of course I support freedom of inquiry, but as long as it's not antithetical to some social justice calculus. No, 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 and no. Right? There is no forbidden knowledge. There is no freedom of speech, but you're either pregnant or you're not. There is no but. Now, there is the usual proviso, for example, for freedom of speech. You can't defame. You can't libel. You can't engage in a direct incitement. You can't say, at the corner of Buffalo Street and Cayuga, when they come out from the synagogue, let's all go kill the Jews. That's incitement to violence. But if you want to stand up on a podium and say, Judaism is a bunch of crock, well, it's too bad you say that, but in a free society, that's what we have to bear. This is from an article written by a very liberal professor. I won't read you the whole thing, but he's basically saying, I have intentionally adjusted my teaching materials as the political winds have shifted. I basically don't teach a single word or utter a single syllable that might offend a single person. Is this the way you want your professors to walk into your classroom and teach your children? Not very good. Let's go on. This is a... So in evolutionary medicine, there is this idea of the hygiene hypothesis. The hygiene hypothesis works as follows. Let me first explain it, and then I'll link it to echo chambers in universities. The hygiene hypothesis basically argues that if you look, for example, at children who grew up exposed to allergens versus children who grew up in very sterile environments, no pollutants. The children who grew up with a lot of allergens end up having fewer autoimmune diseases, for example, asthma. Why? Because the immune system expects to be triggered. It expects to face stressors for it to operate optimally. So now apply that principle to the human mind and your ability to critically think. My ability to be the best debater possible rests on the premise of being exposed to opposing ideas. That's how I hone my arguments. That's how I can build those nomological networks of cumulative evidence that I mentioned earlier. If I only allowed people in the room who agree with me, then I wouldn't be as good of a debater as I might otherwise be. And so this principle of hygiene hypothesis is exactly applicable to the types of echo chambers we see in universities where you cancel someone because, you know, their words are violence and so on and so forth. Now, how does that arise? How do you build echo chambers of conformity? You do so by having all your professors be of one political orientation. So this was a study that was done in 2018 by Langbert, with whom I've communicated briefly at some point. This shows you the ratio of Democrats to Republicans across disciplines. Okay? So the best possible ratio is in engineering when it's 1.6 to 1 in favor of Democrats. Now, to give you a sense of what 1.6 to 1 is in other scientific contexts, if you usually say you have a 1.2 odds ratio, that means I gave these two drugs, I give a placebo and I give an actual drug, and the the non-placebo is 20% more effective.
So 1.2 is a big effect. So 1.6 is a pretty big effect. But that's the least one. Now, we're going to go to 5.2. We're going to go to 16.8:1. So these are orders of magnitude that you don't see in science. Oh, let's go to communications at 133:1. So you're more likely to run into a unicorn than you are likely to run into a Republican who's a sociology professor. So look for a winged horse before you look for a sociology professor who's Republican. Now, is that a good thing? Well, in some fields, it won't matter what my political orientation is as a professor, right? Whether I am a Democrat, Republican, liberal, or conservative, evolution is evolution. But in fields where there are valuable debates to be had on both sides of the aisle, is death penalty a good thing or a bad thing? Should the policy be an isolationist one, or should the United States intervene in any places? There are very valuable arguments to be had on both sides. So imagine that you don't have that in your classrooms, because every single professor that you're ever going to meet, certainly in fields in politics and in law and in communications and so on, are astronomically of one ideological bent. You're cheating your students. Now here is, so every single day at my university, I receive another email telling me how we need to be better allies to women in the university. Because it turns out that, you know, we still live in Waziristan, where the Taliban is stopping women from attending universities. Even though the chair of my department is a woman, the associate dean of research is a woman, not the president, but it's almost all women. Okay, here's a study by the U.S. government. Right? Okay, you ready for this? This is the U.S. government looking at the ratio of male to female graduates, and I'm going to build the data matrix for you across four levels of education: associate's degree, which is a 2-year degree, half a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a doctorate. So there are four, in the matrix, there's four levels of education across five racial categories: white, black, Hispanic, indigenous, whatever, native, and so on. So the matrix is 4x5. So there are 20 cells. I guess you read it already. I should have not shown you. When I usually ask the students or lecture without, how many of those cells do you think men outnumber women? Because if there's a huge problem in terms of, we need to solve the Waziristan Taliban problem, we need to get more women involved, well, 20 of the 20 cells would be more men. Well, 20 out of 20 cells across every racial category and every level of educational attainment, women today outnumber men. In many cases, by a big margin. So it was true that 100 years ago, there was institutionalized, misogynistic barriers for women to enter many fields. And then we worked hard and we solved it. And then a honest interlocutor says, well, there's now a new reality, so I update my narrative. But here we don't update our narratives, even though women now we should be doing the opposite. There's not enough men that are going to university. Let's flip the narrative. We can't disassociate ourselves from that victimhood narrative. So even though the data couldn't be more fully antithetical to the position, I still get every day, how are you going to help your female students? Well, I don't help my students as a function of their menstrual status. I help them as a function of how talented they are. Or actually, it doesn't matter. They need my help, they get help. So how do we save our universities? I've got about a few more slides, and then I think I'm right on cue in terms of taking questions. So how do we save our universities? Number one, pursue knowledge unencumbered by ideological activism. No knowledge is forbidden if gathered objectively using the scientific method. Universities are not places where you train activists. Universities are places where you enrich human minds. And I'm not an elitist, a disciplinary elitist, that I say, oh, it's only science that matters, but not Shakespeare. You could study art history and be fully intellectually enriched. But it has to be wedded to reason, to logic, to, where it's relevant to the scientific method. We're not here to create little Che Guevara activists. Number two, no more identity politics. Instead, promote the dignity of the individual rather than supporting oppression Olympics and victimology poker. No more coddling of the culture of offense and the ethos of perpetual victimhood. A just society is rooted in the ethos of a meritocracy. We are not social ants. Why did I say that? E.O. Wilson, the famous Harvard biologist who is an entomologist by training, he studied social ants, and regrettably he passed away recently, a giant intellectual, when he was famously asked once, what are your views on socialism / communism? He said, great idea, wrong species. Okay? That's one of my favorite quotes of all time because it's incredibly pithy and incredibly powerful. It shows what happens when you understand animal behavior and you can draw an analogy or a homology, depending on the context, to a human context, right? Social ants, by definition, the way they're structured in their evolutionary history, you've got a reproductive queen, and then you've got a bunch of worker ants, a bunch of soldier ants that are completely indistinguishable from each other. So communism, which seeks to create equality across everyone, works perfectly for social ants. Human beings are not social ants. Some of us are taller, shorter, smarter, dumber, harder working, less harder working, more motivated, less motivated. So the ethos of diversity, inclusion, equity, or as I like to order the acronym, DIE, because it's where meritocracy goes to die, is a cancer to human dignity. It cloaks itself in the coat of progressivism. It's a cancer. Okay? We're not social ants. Number five, promote an ethos of intellectual and political diversity. Number six, again, none of these should require me to say them, but regrettably, it does. All ideas, beliefs, ideologies are open to criticism, debate, mocking, ridicule, and other forms of scrutiny. Nothing is sacrosanct. Nothing is blasphemous. Nothing. Okay. And then finally, science, reason, and logic, and a commitment to evidence-based thinking, trump ideology, hurt feelings, and all that other faux intellectual gibberish. Now, this one is not meant to simply be a frivolous attempt to promote my current book, which is a book on happiness. I read this because it is so powerful. It's in the epigraph of one of the chapters where I talk about the importance of resilience and anti-fragility of failure. It's a quote by the Stoic philosopher Seneca. And so I'll read it and I'll just explain it briefly. No tree which the wind does not often blow against is firm and strong, for it is stiffened by the very act of being shaken and plants its roots more securely. Those which grow in a sheltered valley are brittle. But what is that basically saying? Trees that face the stressors, just like the kids who face the allergens and therefore don't develop asthma, trees that face stressors have much less brittle trunks and have much deeper roots. Those that don't can easily be uprooted. And so imagine if you're constantly coddling students, oh, you're okay, please don't be hurt, right? If I in this book, by the way, I talk about some of the training that I had. I'm saddened that some of my former professors are not here today, including my doctoral supervisor. But if you saw how exacting they were, how demanding they were and what they expected of me, there was no coddling and let's hug it out. There was, you're going to go out into the world, we're going to make sure you're going to be ready for the world. And guess what? They did a great job. That's why I love Cornell, because we didn't have all that I'm okay, you're okay nonsense. Last slide, and then I turn it to you. It's a long quote at the end of the parasitic mind, but it's really powerful and hopefully empowering people to find their voice. People are terrified to be called bigot, right? So that gun is loaded. Don't say a word or I'll release it. So let me read it for you. To criticize Islam does not make you an Islamophobe, a nonsensical term, nor a hater of individual Muslims. To scrutinize radical feminism does not make you a misogynist. To question open borders does not make you a racist. You can have an open heart filled with empathy and compassion and yet reject open borders. To assert that trans women, i.e. biological males,
should not be competing in athletic competitions with biological females does not make you a transphobe. Many situations in life involve a calculus of competing rights. With that in mind, the right of your 8-year-old daughter to feel comfortable and safe in a public bathroom supersedes that of a 230-pound, 6-foot-2 trans woman. To reject the idea that so-called other forms of knowing, whether the indigenous way of knowing or postmodernism, are as valid as the scientific method does not make you a closed-minded bigot. To reject the hysterical demonization of white men as exemplars of toxic masculinity and white supremacy does not make you Adolf Hitler. The name-calling accusations are locked and loaded threats ready to be deployed against people who are too afraid to be accused of being racist or misogynist, and so they cower in silence. Keep your mouth shut and not in agreement, or else be prepared to be feathered and tarred. Don't fall prey to this silencing strategy. Be assured in your principles and stand ready to defend them with the ferocity of a honey badger. Thank you very much. And now I will take your questions.
Thank you very much for coming out tonight.
Pleasure.
I have a question about an article I actually read in one of my political philosophy classes, written by Professor Kate Mann here at the Cornell Philosophy Department. It was in 2015, and she laid out a case for trigger warnings and why professors should put trigger warnings in their syllabi, should offer them in their slide presentations, and she paints trigger warnings in a pretty benign light. She says that really it's just a warning for students before providing some type of explicit content. And she says she agrees with the concept of open inquiry and debate that you laid out here today, but says in order to reach that point, there need to be trigger warnings so that students can rationally engage with the subject. I'm not sure if you've read the article, but I think that lays it out pretty well.
I don't think I've read that specific article, but I've read several positions on why trigger warnings are necessary. So at one point, I facetiously had a trigger warning for my MBA class. It was called Trigger Warning, Life is Your Trigger Warning. And that was it. Look, I had an MBA student 2 years ago get very angry. And he actually, I think he filed a complaint. Because I hadn't put a trigger warning when talking about the evolutionary roots of anorexia nervosa. Well, first, there's a trigger warning because he knew someone who had an eating disorder. And also, there was a trigger warning because when I'm talking about the evolutionary roots of anorexia nervosa, I talk about something called the reproductive suppression model, which I won't get into the details, but talks about possible miscarriages and so on. And the fact that I used the word miscarriage is that should have had a trigger warning because he knew somebody at work that had recently had a miscarriage. So that professor of yours, is it a she or a he? She?
Kate Mann, she's not my professor.
Okay, whatever. I just want to use the right pronoun.
Sure.
So does she think that, so if I were discussing war, there should be a trigger warning for that. If I discuss miscarriage, trigger warning. If I discuss criminality, trigger warning. If I discuss in my evolution psychology courses, child abuse, how step-parents are much more likely to commit child abuse, trigger warning. If I want to discuss marital infidelity, trigger warning. So there is almost nothing of any consequence or value that I could ever lecture on any topic that is of any value that doesn't require trigger warning. So that professor is an imbecile. Yes.
Hi.
Oh, I think you have to have the mic. But I'll take your question. No problem.
Hi. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Coming and thank you for being brave. And I don't know how many times you've tried to be canceled. Probably a few more on the way, but thank you for standing up for.
Well, it's been very nice here. I was expecting much worse things, so thank you for being.
When and how do you think the parasite will end? Do you think it will have to get so bad that it destroys itself, like
right.
communism, for example?
So
how do you proceed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are several ways to answer this, and I kind of hinted at this at lunch today with some of the folks that I went out with for lunch. In terms of the battlefield of ideas, it'll take a while for us to administer the mind vaccine to go back to reason. It's just because in the same way that it took, I mean, depending on the parasitic idea, it took between 40 and 90 years for it to proliferate. So, for example, cultural relativism is an idea that was started by Franz Boas, a cultural anthropologist, nearly 100 years ago. And then his students were trained in culture. So that history goes back to 90 years. Radical feminism and some of its tenets is more like 40 years ago. So it depends on the idea pathogen. So it will take, you know, a while. But if we're able to activate the courage of people, hence activate your inner honey badger, if we can get the silent majority to find their spines, to grow a proverbial pair and speak out, then you can reverse things very quickly. The problem is that most people privately agree with you, but then they don't know that all the other people agree with you. But I just happen to be the repository of all of them writing to me saying, oh, shh, I agree with you, but shh, please don't say that I agree with you, right? But if everybody stands up and says, come on, enough of this nonsense, then it goes away very quickly. So there is a optimistic perspective where we can resolve this very quickly if everybody in the silent majority finds their voice, but the longer battle will just take longer. For that's why I do what I do, because more, you know, that's how I encourage people to speak up. So it'll take a while. I think there's also this lady that wants to. Oh. There's this lady.
Oh, you hit.
Hi, thank you.
Sure, as you wish.
Okay. So my question has to do with when you were discussing, also goes back to when you were talking about the OBGYNs and the ideas of...
You want me to go back to the slide?
I have something also on this slide that I would... So I don't mind.
Okay.
But so like in a sentence here, you have a reference which is to assert that a trans woman, parentheses, biological male, not be competing, yada, yada, yada. So you're doing the distinction here that women, when used with the qualifier trans woman, it's something different than what we would consider biological sex, male and female. So just how would you, do you recognize that there is a distinction between maybe like the gender signifier of the word woman that can be used without disqualifying biological sex?
There is a thing called gender dysphoria, and it existed in the DSM, right? That doesn't mean that if you're gender dysphoric, you get to usurp the biological marker woman, right? So let me put it another way. Oftentimes, the transgender people say, you're being transphobic and not allowing us to compete. It's a right issue. And by me not being able to play handball or soccer with other women, even though I'm a male who identifies as a woman, you're transgressing against my rights. How about the rights of all the biological women against whom you're playing? What are their rights? So if you're a feminist who is into women's rights, how do you navigate through the calculus of that conundrum? Do transgender rights supersede the rights of the woman who would have been on the podium, who was taken off the podium because 6'4" woman Leah Thomas decided that she's a female? Yes, go ahead.
So I think that there's a lot more nuance than the way that you framed that, but it's also, I would say, kind of irrelevant to what my question was.
What's the nuance?
I think that we can have a positive discourse about whether or not trans individuals should be, what types of sports they can be competing in. I think that there is such thing as an unfair biological advantage. Are just in day-to-day life, what is there really any harm, I guess, in saying that a trans woman can be a woman? Yes, a trans woman is still biologically male, but woman refers to the social construct of gender, not biological sex.
Call yourself whatever you want. Once it infringes on the rights of others, then we have a problem, right? So you want me to call you woman in the privacy of our dyadic conversation? Great. In other words, I don't go out of my way, nor do I espouse that other people be frivolously mean to
the transgender people, right? So in a, if a student came up to me and said, you know, I used to be Bob and my name is Linda, then I'm going to say, okay, maybe I just need to respect their thing and I'll try my best to honor that. But once we step on the field where now your self-identity somehow is more important than the rights of every other biological woman, then that's a moral question that we need to navigate. I think that no, transgender rights don't supersede biological women's rights.
Professor Saad, thank you so much for the great event. I must apologize if my question was answered in the book. Okay. I expected the books to arrive by the weekend, but I got them today, so I didn't get a chance to finish them.
Sure.
Nevertheless, it's about limitation of science. You mentioned that reason, science, that approach would essentially be the cure for the parasite on the campus. But do you see the limitations of science, and how can science answer the question where would we need to stop conducting an experiment, right?
I mean, there are...
Do we do morals? Do we do human cloning experiments on humans? Like those questions. How can science answer those questions? And do you think that religion is also a very necessary element? I know your speech was mostly focused on the reason.
Sure.
Like, Jordan
Peterson
stakes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Great question. So there are several ways I can answer this. So there is the, so Stephen Jay Gould, who's now the late Stephen Jay Gould, who was a Harvard paleontologist, espoused what was called the NOMA principle. NOMA stands for non-overlapping magisterium. What he's talking about there is what's called an accommodationist view between science and religion. So he's saying, look, science and religion operate in different spheres. They answer different questions, example, morality, and therefore they shouldn't have to be competing with each other. There's a bunch of stuff that science does really well, and there's a bunch of stuff that religion does really well, and they don't have to overlap. Other people who are non-accommodationists would say, no, there is nothing that's outside the purview of the scientific method, right? So morals themselves can be studied. As a matter of fact, there's many, many evolutionists have studied the evolution of moral systems, right? Usually the religious folks say, no, there couldn't be an evolutionary mechanism that led to our moral calculus. But there is no epistemological reason to think that. So I happen to be someone who understands the value of religion as long as it doesn't impede in explaining things that are contrary to science, right? So for example, if a geologist says that this is the age of this rock, and that contradicts a young Earth creationist, now the young Earth creationist is impeding on scientific facts that are clear, and he's violating that. Therefore, I say religion has to bow down. But if there are other things that religion offers you, you know, an understanding of the afterlife, which science can't, well, then good for you. So I'm not sure where I exactly fit. At times when I'm charitable, I want to be accommodating towards religion. Other times when I see religion espousing certain things that are, for example, evolutionary theory, there are some, you know, hardcore, for example, Christian right folks who say that that's blasphemous. Well, it's hard for me to be an evolutionary psychologist and agree with them. So it really depends on each issue.
May I ask
Paul? I don't know. He's holding the mic.
I'm curious to hear if you can tell us more about the prescription you offer. It seems like it was all compressed into the last few sentences here about being brave. I'll push back a bit that I don't think the only problem is bravery alone. I think there's at least several cases I can think of off the top of my head where it's rational not to say something.
Personally, I'm a six-year grad student. I don't want to lose my collaborators and have to be here much longer. So it's rational not to say something about the tampons in the men's room, even though every man I've talked to has agreed that maybe that's not a policy priority. Who is going to die on that hill? It makes sense for nobody.
So
it's not just about bravery.
Right.
How do we actually begin?
Do you think when I go into campus with security and I'm worried whether I'm going to be decapitated, that might be just as important as you being a 60? In other words, we all have a something to bear on the cross, right? Now, I understand. It's not. I don't exist in a utopian world where I don't recognize risk-reward calculus, right? And I understand that there are real, you know, I'm not tenured, so I'm worried about speaking out. I'm a graduate student. I'm not. But as I explained to Randy earlier at lunch, there is always a capacity to use that argument all the way to retirement. I've experienced it with a million people who write to me. Professor Saad, I really admire your bravery. I'm tenured, but I'm going up for full professor. I simply can't speak about menstrual equity. Professor Saad, I really love you. I'm a full professor, but I'm going for chair professorship, so I can't speak out. In other words, there's always a valid risk-reward argument for why it shouldn't be me now speaking. You know those guys that came off the amphibian machines on Normandy, where there were these guys called Nazis that were mowing them down with machine guns? They seem to have said, yeah, I'll take the risk. In other words, I'm not minimizing the fact that people have to bear a cost. But war, whether it be physical war or a battle of ideas, has casualties. And if everybody says, it's great, you got sad that you speak, but I simply can't, then you are doing diffusion of responsibility, right? And so, no, that really is the reason for the problem, because everybody agrees with you privately, and everybody says, there is a unique, narcissistic, self-serving reason why I shouldn't speak out. But please put your head on the guillotine for the rest of us. I really love your honey badger attitude, Professor Saad. But then I walk into campus, and my wife, 5'3", walks behind me, looking around to make sure that I don't get knifed, because she's afraid for me to go to campus. What's the cost that I was bearing there? So no, you have to decide for yourself whether you'd rather live 5 minutes with dignity and stand tall, or live for 500 years cowering on your knees. Each one of us has to make that decision.
Mic is working. To address his concern or consideration about religion and science, religion deals in faith. There are two kinds of faith. There's faith in things which cannot be proven. There's faith in things which have been disproven. Religion deals in the first. Science should be addressing the second.
I mean, you want me to comment or just...
Please do.
I mean, it's a complicated story. Look, so some of you may have heard, for example, of Popper's falsification principle, the idea that for something to be scientific, it needs to be falsified. So let's take, for example, the principle of destiny, okay, which actually exists as part of an ethos of fatalism in some religions, right? It's my destiny. It's written in the sky. It's meant to be, God willing, inshallah, right? So how would I test destiny? Well, let's see if I can run an experiment. If I go, I want to run an experiment whether it's my destiny to be hit by a truck when I cross the road. So I cross the road and the truck doesn't hit me. What's the conclusion? It was my destiny. I cross the street and the truck does hit me. What do I conclude? It was my destiny. Therefore, there is no state in the world where there is a way to falsify the principle of destiny. All roads lead to destiny. So I have to look at each of the different religious arguments, but the problem is that many religious statements, to the extent that they fail the most basic tenet of Popperian falsification, they're useless to me. Yeah. So that's why I was saying that while I am sympathetic to why religion exists, so some people think that I'm hostile to religion. I'm not at all. As a matter of fact, as an evolutionist, I understand that the default value of humans is to be believers. It's a lot easier to be a believer than to be a non-believer, because regrettably, we have a prefrontal cortex that allows us to realize that the party is very short and we're on a death sentence. And what better way for me to swallow a pill called, don't worry, the party's going to go on. It's a lot more somber for me to say, the party ends here. So it's a complicated story. I try to be as respectful as possible to the religious, but as a purist academic, I'm not that into it.
Thank you very much, Professor, for coming and speaking to us today. I wondered what advice you would give to students who find themselves in academic departments where critical thinking is not only not encouraged but actually penalised. To give a brief anecdote, I go to university in the UK, and one of my first university essays in my first year of undergrad was how is my discipline impacted by a colonialism and how it's inherently colonial. I wrote an essay, compared it with some of my friends. I promised to everyone in the room that I backed it up with evidence and articles, and I lost 20 marks because I didn't think that my discipline was inherently colonial and inherently racist, etc. I just wondered what you think students should do in that situation where many of their departments...
It's like the question that the gentleman, the physics student, said. I really do... I don't want to sound as though I'm unsympathetic to the calculus that people have to go through. I get that. But again, if every person has exactly that thought, then here I stand, as Martin Luther did, and I'm the only guy speaking. But if suddenly you've... Now, by the way, you don't have to be a martyr. You could, for example, maybe you're going to the pub privately with four of your friends, maybe raise it there. So we can each decide how to modulate the risk, but what I implore everybody to do is simply not say, I'm not going to do it because my selfish careerist interests are too important to put myself on the line. If each of us do that, we lose. But if someone says, you know what, I've had enough of this, and then he gets up, and then I give courage to her and him, suddenly there's strength in number, and we will reverse it. So I appreciate your calculus. And by the way, I get tons of those questions. I have to write a political science paper on Palestine versus Israel, and my professor is a free Palestine, but I am. What should I do? Well, the purist in me says, you can't modulate what you think. What kind of academic would I be? What kind of professor worth his salt would I be to say, you know what, just completely lie on the paper so that at least you can get an A? So again, from a purist perspective, you have to have integrity, but I understand your concern. Sorry, but it's not me who chooses, but yeah, you got it.
Sure. Yeah, I wanted to ask if there's a point of no return, if you can be so infested with the parasite so that you receive any other differentiated opinion as something that requires an immunological response. And then if not, what are some strategies based on the developmental stages that can be more effective? Say someone whose roots are so deeply ingrained in the sheltered valley, that might be more effort rather than like an early adolescent whose roots are more shallow.
Okay, so I'll answer the last part first, and we talked about this today at lunch. One of the reasons that it's really worrisome to see some of these parasitic ideas being introduced earlier and earlier is precisely because the ideologues understand that young children don't have the cognitive inoculation against a lot of this nonsense, right? And so, yes, that is a problem. I was recently asked, I appeared on a show, a British show actually, hosted by a psychiatrist, and at the end of the show, he asked me a question which surprisingly in all the years that I've been doing this, I don't think anyone had ever asked me. He said, in your 30 years as a professor, what is the singular thing that has most surprised you about human behavior? And so he took me off guard, I had to think about it for a second, and I said, so to your question, I said, the inability of people to change their opinions once it is solidly anchored, which, by the way, speaks to, in a sense, contradicts my nomological networks, right? Because my nomological networks is saying, if you at least grant me the courtesy to show you the nomological network, I can flip you. But if you go, la, 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 I don't want the vaccine, I can never get to you. And so one of the things that I struggle with is when to walk away from a person knowing that no amount of nomological network is ever going. So I've become pretty good at quickly gauging where if there is an opportunity for us to dialogue, or else I just walk away. You're not worth it.
Thank you.
Sure. You mentioned that there has to be a balance of rights. But I think that's where the most interesting questions lie.
I can't hear you too well.
Hi. You mentioned that there has to be a balance of rights. And I think that's where almost all of the most interesting questions lie. But I see that often you focus on arguments of people that you consider having like a parasitic mind. And I know those people are very ubiquitous and have very simplistic and hypocritical beliefs. But I find that those are often like the most low-hanging fruits, and that there are often very interesting balance of rights questions that you can describe and talk about. And many of the quotes of like the people that you showed are clearly ridiculous like positions that are very easily defeated. But many of those positions are actually very interesting and do follow some sort of balance of rights question that is you can go into and research or discuss. I haven't read your book. Maybe you talk about it more. But do you take the time to actually seek out those more difficult discussions on those each individual topics that are often people have very like simplistic positions on?
So give me an example of a more what you call balance versus the low-hanging fruit.
Sure. So for example, the one about Twitter censoring the Hunter Biden laptop story. The position you put is something like it was deontological, like it was good because it prevented Trump from getting power. But there's a much more interesting case of like, you can see in like the Twitter files where they're discussing the different topics of whether this counts as some sort of like hacked materials policy. There's much, and is this something that should be posted, propagated? Like if somebody found nudes of your loved one, would you want that to be shareable in the platform to the public? That could be an interesting question where it's a balance of rights versus the simplistic, hey, they just want to buy into it.
So you're saying there might be multiple causes that or factors that we have to look into,
yeah.
And of course that's true. But to that question of the Hunter Biden, most people weren't saying, well, there's really a nuanced reason why. Most people who were openly stating why it was perfectly reasonable to suppress it did not go into all the nuanced arguments you're talking about. Maybe the Twitter files did.
But do you take the time to like seek out the more difficult challenges to that particular topic? Like, I feel like it's very easy to like point out like a very common problem of people having very simplistic, very like having positions just to benefit their side or political team. But a lot of these topics are very interesting.
So as one of my former professors at Cornell said, when I asked him a question, he said to me, you know, Gad, I am capable of complex thought. And so I'll answer that to you. Yes, I'm able to be nuanced and look at balanced things. But when it comes to the issue of deontological versus consequentialist, it's really not that nuanced. There are some principles that are inviolable, right? Freedom of speech is inviolable, short of defamation, child pornography, libel, direct incitement of violence, screaming fire in a cinema. That's it. Those are the asterisks. Anything else you want to say? Judaism is a piece of crock. It's ugly you say that. There is no nuance. In a free society, you're allowed to say that. That's it. Anything? Yes, go ahead. I can't hear you.
I said, good to hear you in person.
Thank you.
I like your approach to serious things. The sense of humor that you bring to the depth of knowledge and explaining things is something that I cherish a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And that makes people like me want to listen to you, even if maybe we may disagree on some issues.
Yes.
I believe you, permit that. Looking at the history of the university here in America, maybe starting from Harvard and how Harvard started and where Harvard is today, which I believe you include in your own critique as having been infected with a parasitic mindset as well. It took a lot of time for the universities to be where they are today. And you seem to be very optimistic of the fact that there is a solution to it based on the profiled solution that you gave. Since it took this long to get to this place, how long do you think it's going to take to get to the place where
yes.
you think the university should be?
Yes.
And how optimistic are you about that?
I'm optimistic only to the extent that the totality of people don't go la la la, right? So in other words, as long as I'm given the opportunity to administer the mind vaccine, then I can inoculate you. The challenge comes, so I think several of you have already pointed to this, the challenge comes from people who say, I don't want your mind vaccine. Your mind vaccine is polluted. You're a Nazi. I don't trust your mind vaccine. Well, then there's no way for me to find a meaningful place for us to even have a debate. So as long as there is an honest effort for people to hear the message, I am optimistic that I can flip them. And when I say I mean not just me. I mean reason, science, logic, common sense, reality. These parasitic ideas are only alluring because they free us. So I talk about this in The Parasitic Mind. They free us from the shackles of reality, right? Postmodernism frees me from the shackles of there being even a truth, right? Transgender activism frees me from the reality of my genitalia. Radical feminism frees me from the innate sex differences that men and women exhibit. So each of these parasitic ideas cater to a need for me to escape from the pesky shackles of reality. As long as you're willing to come to this talk, hear me out, read the book, I think there is optimism. So I truly believe that we can flip it around. It won't be overnight, but it won't take as long as how long it took us to get here. So it'll be shorter, but it requires work. It requires for all of you to speak out, get engaged, and hopefully we can turn the ship. And thank you for the comment about the humor. It's funny because oftentimes when I'll just end with this, Randy. Oftentimes when I'm approached by someone in the street, 7 out of 10 times, it'll be about my humor more than about something professorial, which exactly speaks to your point. Because humor is a very, very powerful way to disarm people, to make them stop and listen to you, to connect with you. That's why, as I mentioned earlier to Randy, dictators will usually first eliminate the satirists, the humorists, because they're the ones who've got the real power. It's the power of their stinging tongue. It's the power of their pen that will flip the dictator. They don't care about the tall guys with the big muscles. I can get rid of those easy. It's the guy who can make everybody laugh at my stupidity that I need to worry about. So yes, humor is very effective. That's why I use it.
I want you to know that you've all been vaccinated. And not only that, but it's like the Sabin vaccine. It's a live virus. So if you talk to other people, they'll also become vaccinated. So please pass this great
What's happening?
Bombs going off.
I'd like to thank Zach again for a great talk.
Thank you so much.